Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
He calls it the lost decade. Well, that one is now in the rearview mirror, and the question is, what do we see on the road ahead? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Dan Haar is with me in the studio. Dan's a frequent contributor to The Full Story, and Mr. Haar is an associate editor and columnist for Hearst Connecticut Media. He recently wrote a column with the title, Connecticut's Lost Decade and How to Avoid a Repeat. I got to tell you, got some instant response, including from the very top, Governor Ned Lamont. And we're going to talk about Dan's column and the responses, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think? Was the decade lost economically? Can there be a turnaround? Is Connecticut just too hard on itself? Or are the problems so big? Transportation, pensions, housing, that the state's going to need to work even harder to dig itself out? And if that's the case, who's going to pay for the big shovel? You can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Facebook. Our page is Full Story WSHU. Mr. Haar, always good to see you.
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
Thank you for
I have an answer to your first question.
Which is?
The answer is, the rearview mirror is clear now, but the windshield remains foggy.
Foggy. Very nice. Why was it the lost decade for Connecticut?
Well, it was the lost decade. The underlying reasons why it's the lost decade are things that we continue to debate. Connecticut did not grow in the decade starting from 2010. Really, if you take 2009 as the baseline and you carry that forward to the end of 2019, Connecticut showed, depending on how you measure it, either zero growth or very slight growth or slight negative growth. The nation grew by about 22-23%. So that's obviously an extremely dramatic divergence. And that plays itself out in all kinds of measures, including, most importantly, job creation, in which I don't want to throw a lot of numbers at you, but very simply, we grew by 4% during the decade, a total of 4% of jobs, or about 60,000 jobs, 65,000 jobs, as compared to 15% for the nation. And I also compared Massachusetts to Connecticut and the nation. And Massachusetts more or less tracks the nation. They're a little stronger in some areas and a little weaker in others. And so it's not good for us, and it's not just a regional thing. And then we can talk about the reasons. But the problem is we simply didn't grow economically during the decade.
For those who don't know you or know your writings, I want to mention that even though you're a columnist now, you were a business editor for many years. And so you've been following this for a long time.
Yeah, I've been following the Connecticut economy more or less full time since May of 1995. So coming up on 25 years. I was a reporter before that. So certainly all reporters are focused to a degree on the economy. I was covering the town of East Hartford. East Hartford had Pratt & Whitney, which in 1992, while I was covering it, announced that at some point in the future, we may no longer make jet engines in Connecticut. And that was the shot that created the incentive for then Weicker and all the governors since to say, holy cow, we need to really do something to keep these companies here. That first shot from Pratt & Whitney in 1992, albeit Joe McGee, who we all know from Business Council of Fairfield County, was the Economic Development Commissioner. He was already underway with incentives, but that was the thing that really sent everybody in a dither.
That was the real wake-up call at that time. Now, is this the fault of what we're talking about? Is this the fault of one party, the Democrats or the Republicans, or can you spread the blame across the board here?
It's Bob's fault from Stanford. We're going to be talking to him later. it's two things that have opposite solutions. One is Connecticut has a poorly updated infrastructure, and especially cities. There is no magnet city. The states that do well are the cities that are the states that have a big city, especially one of the big eight: Brooklyn, Manhattan. I count them as two. Boston, Seattle. You know the eight.
Sure.
That's where all our kids are.
Yes, right? Yes, they are.
So those are magnet cities for millennials and magnet cities for retirees and magnet cities for a lot of people. We don't have a magnet city. We, as we're going to be talking in this show, we have a couple of cities that work pretty well, but we don't have a national magnet city. The second problem is cost. And that's what the race was about in 2018. What Bob Stefanowski was harping on was the cost of living in Connecticut is too high compared to what people get. Suburbs fell out of favor. We hope that suburbs fall back into favor with millennials who are 20-something and become 30-something and start having kids. That's mm-hmm. what I'm counting on, that one of them is going to buy my house and happy days will be here again.
Our friend Keith Fanoff from ctmirror.org has told us that the pension crisis, and you write in your article that right now the unfunded pension liability is about $100 billion. And he says this pension crisis can actually be traced back to the 1930s. So with that in mind, did the lost decade come about because of overall problems, not just pensions, that go back decades and decades and decades?
Yes. Just to be clear, the $100 billion includes pension and health.
Right.
And I think it's 99, so we're not at 100 yet.
Okay,
we're
going close to it.
I think we're never going to hit 100, despite what a lot of people think. That there was a study that showed it was 124. As you can well imagine, these things are not a science.
Right.
There isn't an amount of money that you can go look up and say, how far behind are we? Because that depends on 18,000 factors. But in 1939, we started the pensions in Connecticut. And only in 1973 did we get the bright idea to actually stop doing pay-as-you-go. As people retired, we paid out of, you know, the box, mm-hmm. the kitty. I can picture Governor Meskel with a box, you know, handing out checks. And we started. But unfortunately, as we've all reported, including Keith, we didn't set aside enough money from the outset. And then when things got bad in the 91 to 98 period, no, really 91 to 94, that was the terrible recession, we stopped setting aside money, which is exactly the opposite of what you're supposed to do. And then under REL, we continued to not set aside money. So now it's just exactly as if you had a credit card bill of $50,000, and suddenly with interest, you let it go for 2 years, and suddenly with interest, your payments are now $1,000 a month just to stay zero. That's where we are. Essentially, our payments are $2 billion a year just to go nowhere. And so that's the problem.
We have a number of guests coming up in the next segment, including Fred Carstensen, UConn professor, and we're going to be talking with someone about the housing market. But with the 4 minutes that we have left in this segment, give me some of your proposed solutions as to how Connecticut can make a comeback.
Well, the first thing I suggested is we need to take a middle path. And I think the states that have done well, like Massachusetts and to a lesser extent, you know, the Carolinas, have had a mixed political environment, right? They're not run by one party. We saw what happened. We get that if you try to just cut services and cut taxes like they tried to do in Kansas, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't work if you just keep adding expenses. So a middle path on policy is one solution that I have. And that, I think Connecticut is actually pretty good on middle path in terms of rhetoric. I get that we've got, you know, Senator Fasano sniping with the governor. I get that. And that's normal, good, healthy stuff. But in terms of really, like the type of stuff we see with the Trump Washington, we're really not that bad. And we saw that when the Senate had 18-18 in 2016 and 17, they were able to get reforms done as a compromise that worked. That's why we have a $3 billion budget, not a budget surplus. We still have budget deficits. Mm-hmm. We have a $3 billion rainy day fund, right?
Now a record number.
It's a record number, and it's going to hit the recommended 15%, more or less. I think it's 14 by July. And it may not, it's not going to hit $3 billion. I think it hits 2.8, but let's not quibble over $200 million. That was the result of a compromise in the budget making between Republicans and Democrats that said we can't use all of the capital gains taxes on operations. We have to set aside a certain amount of it into the rainy day fund. That's one thing that I'm saying. Another thing is I've never been to a state that was so down on itself and a little bit more rah-rah Connecticut, and I hate to be a cheerleader, but a little bit more cheerleading would be in order. Like, you don't see that when you go to New York. You don't see it when you go to North Carolina. You do see it in New Jersey, where I'm from. So maybe it's me.
No, it's over the years I've noticed that for some reason, and I'm not sure why this has happened over the last 10, 15 years or so, Connecticutians have... There's something about what's going on nowadays, a tendency to beat ourselves up.
Well, that's right. And I don't think we saw that in the 80s. I was here starting in the 80s.
Right.
And I don't believe
that
we saw that.
It's a pretty recent development.
One of the reasons for it is the recession of 90 to 94 was, contrary to popular belief, it was much, much worse than the more recent so-called Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Fred Carstensen was calling the early 90s recession the Great Recession. Fred and some other people as well. And so that was really, really devastating. We lost 10% of jobs in that recession as compared to 7% in this last recession. And it lasted a lot longer. So the downturn was a lot longer. So that was a big problem, and that led to some of the, I think, beating up. But I also want to talk about risk. You know, this is a state that has the insurance industry, the financial services industry, and the defense industry. What do all three of those have in common? They are there to control risk. Consequently, the culture of the state is risk-averse at precisely the time when the national economy and the global economy rewards risk. So we need to get out of ourselves.
Change the personality a little bit. We're going to take a short break. We're with Dan Haar. He writes for Hearst Connecticut Media, and he wrote a great column recently entitled Connecticut's Lost Decade. If you want to join in today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU. Remember, you can download the Full Story as a podcast on Google, Apple, Stitcher, or Spotify. We'll take that first break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Once again, if you want to join in with your thoughts, your comments, email them to us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And go to Facebook. We're at Full Story WSHU. Dan Haar is with us, associate editor, columnist for Hearst Connecticut Media. Before we bring in our next guest, Dan, I just want to go back to what you were saying right before the break. And I thought it was such an important point in your column. And you're saying that Connecticut is, one of its nicknames, slogans, if you will, is the land of steady habits. Things don't happen here fast. You know, it's we read about things that are, I was just in California. In California, things happen, and then maybe they'll hit the East Coast a few years later.
We're going to legalize marijuana after Colorado legalizes mushrooms.
Mushrooms. So, but your point is, look, if we're going to change the culture of the state, if we're going to bring the state back, come on, take a chance, take a risk.
Sure, it's easy for me to tell somebody to take a risk with their money. I'm a W-2 employee of a big company. Yes, absolutely. And I do see people taking risks in these industries. Where what we need is for some types of new industries. We're not strong, for example, on software. Software was absolutely explosive in the decade. Software services. Connecticut happened to not be strong in that area because that's a risk-based venture for a lot of people in Connecticut. It's outside of what we do. That hurt us in the decade.
One of the points that you make in the column is housing. How housing is such a problem in Connecticut, and the value of houses simply did not grow like they did in other states specifically, and you mentioned Massachusetts. To talk a little bit about housing, we're going to bring in Jonathan Miller now, who has been with us before. Jonathan is the president and CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers. And Jonathan, welcome back to The Full Story. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be here. Happy to talk about this.
So tell us about Connecticut's housing market. What happened to it over the last decade?
So it's more about what didn't happen. And I think in line with Dan's commentary on the subject, I completely agree. So, for example, we report on market conditions in Fairfield County, and the community is dominated by the securities industry, which has been waning in the city for the last decade. The homeowners in that market were looking at what was happening in New York City post-financial crisis, and they saw a huge housing boom in terms of pricing, volume of activity. And so in Fairfield County, many people priced their homes as if they had a boom as well. Unfortunately, they didn't. And so as a result, you have this massive disconnect between what market value was and what the perception or expectation was. And it's still coming out of that fog. It just didn't see the boom. So, for example, like in a high-end market like Greenwich, Connecticut, you had properties that would be on 3, 4, 5 years and priced, 40, 50% above what they were actually worth. And that's a massive sort of psychological disconnect between reality and the actual economic conditions on the ground.
Well, was that delusional on the part of the homeowners or on the part of the brokers?
I don't think it was the brokers. The brokers weren't in control of that. I call this phenomenon aspirational pricing, where sellers set numbers that don't have any footing in reality. So a simple example would be, a high-end home that's priced at $5 million. You buy it for $5 million, and then you put $1 million into it, and then you put it on the market for $20. And that's what Greenwich had a lot of. And it's taken, 3, 4, 5 years for some of that sort of disconnect to wear off, where there's, been a little bit more sales activity. One of the really interesting things about Connecticut real estate in general, not just Fairfield County, is that with falling mortgage rates on a that's a national economic condition, there are plenty of buyers. The problem is that there is a very much a seller disconnect in terms of what appropriate asking prices are, and as a result, you have diminished activity.
I want to ask you about the numbers and the reason for some of the flatness and decline that we're seeing. If we look at Connecticut as a whole, we were up 7.8% median sale price of a house on the decade. And Massachusetts, for example, was, I believe, 40%. So
right.
Obviously they're zooming way ahead. And we were pretty close to Massachusetts at the start of the decade, but now we're, of course, nowhere close. And let's look at Fairfield County, which is flat, down 1%. Fairfield County
right.
is actually down 1% on the decade. Now, does that mean that any given house is worth, on average, 1% less? My impression is that maybe it means lower-priced houses are selling more often. And it doesn't mean my house lost 1% of its value. That's a big difference to our listeners here. What do you think is happening there in terms of that question?
So you're absolutely right. So the housing price trends in any report, especially when they're aggregated in, one number, speaks to the change in the mix. And it's not to be applied to a specific property. So you're absolutely right. And really where the growth in prices, believe me, I have 4 sons and 3 have bought houses in Fairfield County in the last 2 years. And falling mortgage rates really made all the difference, and they went through bidding wars and very tight in the Norwalk Stamford areas, and but when you look at the top of those respective markets, it's very quiet. So there's definitely been, and this actually falls into affordability as a general comment, where even though the lower priced markets, the starter markets, and the middle of the market have performed relatively well. They've been sort of weighted down in aggregate by the high end, which has been more like a wet blanket.
Yeah.
And things like the SALT tax, the federal tax law change that began in beginning of 2018, those have weighed heavily on housing markets that are high priced with high taxes, yet the starter markets with falling mortgage rates have become less affordable.
What?
In the long run.
What about immigration policy? You said we have buyers, but we could have more buyers if we had the level of immigration that's coming into other states. Connecticut gets about 20,000 foreign immigrants a year. And as you know, we're losing people to other states in net. So we're down about 20,000 a year on losing people to other states. We're up about 20,000 a year on foreign immigration. We're up about 3,000 a year from Puerto Rico, which is a separate category. Do you think we could do more to market ourselves overseas to young families moving to the United States? Or is that that was one of my recommendations. Is that just a pipe dream?
Well, so I really like the idea, and I think the way that we have to think about the state and its economy is we're in competition with other states, and I'm not so sure that that's sort of front and center in terms of thinking about how we go forward. I think, you know, that's how the population, that's how the demand for the housing stock expands, and I would be for anything like that.
Jonathan Miller is the president and the CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers. Thanks, Jonathan. We appreciate the time. Come back soon.
You bet. Anytime. Thank you.
We're going to bring in Fred Carstensen now. He hasn't been with us in a while, and it's great to have him back on the air. Fred Carstensen is professor of finance at UConn at the University of Connecticut. He's the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. How are you, professor? Good to have you back.
Oh, delighted to be on with you.
I'm assuming you've read Dan's column?
Several times.
All right. So what do you think? Was it a lost decade from an economic standpoint?
Oh, Dan's very much on target. I mean, I would have added some additional things, you know, in terms of sort of how dramatic this lost decade has been, because between 1997 and 2007, we had very little job growth, but we grew very strongly in terms of state output, inflation adjusted. It was 3% at a compound rate. And because we had no job growth and little population, if you did that on a per capita basis, we were in the top five states in the country in terms of growth. So we went from an extraordinarily successful decade to a very, very depressing decade.
Oh, you're saying in the 90s, GDP per capita was strong.
Yes.
Excuse me?
He was saying until 2007 or so.
GDP per capita was strong.
Yeah, GDP per capita grew very, very strongly in the decade leading up to the financial tsunami.
Right.
The other two points that I would make in support of Dan's commentary is that the job creation that we have had in Connecticut, he talked about the dramatic decline in the non-durable goods and in finance and insurance, those two sectors. Where we saw very strong job growth was in tourism and hospitality, which is low wage, and in health, which really reflects home health aides, senior centers, which, again, two low-wage areas. So even as we added jobs, the quality of jobs that we have in Connecticut declined significantly. And then the final point that I would add is that he has some very good data on household income and per capita income, where we've held up fairly well. But a large part of that, he mentions the 2,700 jobs with GE Capital. A lot of jobs moved out of Connecticut into the New York metro area, but those people continued to work in Connecticut, I mean live in Connecticut. So we had this enormous surge between 2013 and 2018, 90,000 more people who living in Connecticut took jobs outside of Connecticut, which is one of the reasons that our income tax revenue declined by $500 million relative to household income, is a combined effect of lower incomes in Connecticut and therefore a lower, smaller percentage going into income tax because of the progressive structure of the income tax. But a lot of very high earners having their jobs move out of state, and of course then they're paying their income tax out of state. So it is the way in which this lost decade has hurt us and the way in which it's manifested itself is not, Dan hit it exactly right. In terms of it is a it has been a lost decade where 5-6% tenths of a percent smaller than we were 5% smaller than we were. Our economy now is about where it was in 2005.
Professor, in Dan's article, he quoted one of your fellow economists, Don Klepper-Smith, who said, "I don't think it gets fixed in my lifetime because I don't think we have the political will to fix it." Do you agree with that? Can it be fixed?
Well, you know, I think we've, at the state level, they've done on the fiscal issues, on the unfunded liabilities. I think Dan himself has made this point. If you look at the aggregate of municipal responsibilities and state, we're unusual because we undertook the teacher retirement funds. If you look at us compared to other states on an aggregated basis, we don't look nearly as bad. And we've taken a lot of steps, you know, and our credit rating has been slightly upgraded. The real issue is what he touches on at the end, is we can't afford to have another decade like this. And the real problems that we never adjusted to the modern economy in the sense that we did not take seriously the importance of the IT infrastructure. Rail began it a little bit with the Nutmeg Network, which became accessible to the private sector after the federal government put a big chunk of money in it in 2009, 2010, but we didn't market it. And so we've been bleeding in the information-intensive areas. Connecticut's been singled out in a couple of industry studies for its striking absence of data centers and its weakness in IT infrastructure. I know professionals who've told me that there are some very high-speed fiber optic cables running from Boston to New York through Connecticut. They don't have a single off-ramp in Connecticut because Connecticut just did not take seriously the importance of this. Connecticut put its own backup data center in Massachusetts. it's like you're not even doing what you can in the public sector to support the growth of this and that what's called NAICS 51, which is the information sector, has systematically contracted in Connecticut since 2000. We had almost 40,000 employees. We had shrunk to about 35,000 by 2008, and we're now have shrunk down to about 30,000. I mean, that's a really bad sign. You can't have the most dynamic sector in the nation, in the national economy, which is the NAICS 51.
Professor, we have about 3 minutes. We have about 3 minutes left, so Dan's going to sneak in one more question for you.
People on the great debate about whether costs are driving people out? And I know you and I have talked about this quite a lot. In sum, in net, big picture, are people with money leaving because taxes are too high? Or is it more of a sort of a dynamic picture where we're seeing lack of industry development of the sort that you've been talking about?
Overwhelmingly, it's the lack of employment opportunities here. It's, you know, I mean, obviously some people, but I know people who retire to downtown, you know, Manhattan. I mean, they're giving up 4,000 square foot homes here and they're buying 900 square foot basement apartments. I mean, the idea that, and they're paying higher taxes, but they want, I mean, you touched on the importance of the big, powerful metros with the quality of life that they offer. It's not caught. And remember, Connecticut has among the lowest tax burdens in the nation, according to Ernst & Young. I mean, so businesses aren't leaving because of the taxes. You know, they're leaving for other reasons. I mean, the quality of the workforce, we have not done a good job of creating that education workforce pipeline. There are other areas where, you know, I don't think we've been responsive or creative. We have not paid attention to what other states are doing. We're often, you know, way behind the curve in terms of what best practice is. So Klepper-Smith is putting the wrong emphasis. It's not about political will on that front. It really has to do with, you know, are you going to, you know, construct policies that are coherent and meaningful? Are you going to focus on the dynamic sectors where the growth opportunities are? That's where our real failure has been. We've been transactional rather than developing an ecosystem that is supportive and exploits our very real assets and our very, very favorable location. Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York are all doing very well, and we haven't really sort of tied in and recognized where the opportunities were and taken advantage of them.
Fred Carstensen is professor of finance at UConn at the University of Connecticut. He's the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. Professor, always good to have you on. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. We're going to continue our conversation with Dan, but now we're also going to bring in Bob Lyon. Bob has been with us before. Bob is a member of the City of Stamford Board of Representatives. He's a member of the Urban Redevelopment Committee. And we've asked Bob to come in because Stamford is now the state's, I've been told, third largest city, but there's some debate about that. It might be the state's second largest city
in terms of population.
Now. It has had quite the turnaround in the last 10 to 15 years or so. And if you see, it's downtown nowadays, you see young people there, which is great to see where they weren't there many years ago.
Some of them work in New York.
Some of them work in New York. They do the reverse commute every day, back and forth, some of them. Bob, it's great to have you here. And the reason that we wanted to get you in is because Dan, in his column, and it wasn't just a column about what's bad with Connecticut, Dan is offering solutions. So many people are pointing to Stamford nowadays and saying, look, this is working there. So what is it that you're doing in Stamford that's working?
Well, over the last decade, Stamford has pointed the way. And I think as we follow the solutions that Dan indicated in his article, I think the things that we're doing in Stamford follow those questions. As you had said, we are now the number two city in the state of Connecticut. We are blessed by our proximity to New York City, and we have as many people commuting into Stamford from New York as probably go the other way now because of all the businesses that we have that have set up shop here. We are actually a media capital in our area. A&E Networks, CBS Interactive, Charter Communications is building its world headquarters in two new buildings right by the Stamford train station. ITV America, the NBC Sports Group. Anything you see on the Olympics goes through the lines that are in the south end of Stamford. So specialization is very important, and we've capitalized on that.
Don't forget the Stamford Advocate has it. We're in Stamford, too, still.
That is correct. And what I was going to say also was that the Advocate and the Hearst Papers in general have made a concerted effort to become part of the Stamford community. They've been holding essentially town halls, if you will, where reporters meet with the public, usually in a public setting where you can buy a beer or not.
That's absolutely true.
And that has, I think, built up a relationship between the paper and Dan, and that's, I've come to know him through that. A couple of things I wanted to point out, and I'm going to go by his solutions. One thing he said was to show some Connecticut pride. Well, we started a new holiday in Stamford called Stamford Day. Stamford was founded in 1614, and we have now turned that into a celebration of the diversity of our city. We don't have a majority population anymore. Minorities make up the majority, if I might say. And so we were trying to take pride in that. Embracing risk. We've taken a risk by building up our downtown, especially we have a green space called Mill River Park that is been a tremendous turnover to the pollution and garbage that was in that river, the Annis River, for a long time. We have many, many events there happening all the time. Marketing to immigrants and young parents, we have a group that is trying to create solutions, a parent group that's moving for solutions in that area. Working on cities and transportation, obviously we're very much in favor of the improvement of infrastructure. And as far as equilibrium is concerned, I find that the work on the Board of Representatives is totally nonpartisan. I have as much in common with members of the Republican Party as I do with the majority of the people on the Democratic side. We have something called Stamford Innovation Week that happens every year under John Winkle's leadership. and it's a 3 or 4 day affair, and all kinds of innovators come in, and ideas are workshopped and brought back into the city. We're really going through a renaissance because the mayor has taken it to say, I'm not going to kick it down the road anymore. We have funded our pension liabilities that were unfunded before. And that's given us a AAA bond rating, which is going to help us deal with the biggest issue that we're facing right now, which is how to renovate and replace and create new schools. And we're going to take we're taking a big risk in even investigating a public-private partnership. Don't know if that's going to happen, but we're doing that.
Let me hold you there because I only have you for 3 more minutes. Okay. Because Kevin Lembo is going to be joining us in a moment. With everything that you're saying, and obviously it's working. I've been to Stamford numerous times, and it has been quite the turnaround. How can that be applied to what Dan has written about on a statewide basis? Can you replicate that for the remainder of Connecticut, for the rest of Connecticut?
Number one, you've got to get your financial house in order. Each town has to look at its budget and what they can do and what they can't do. That's why we're looking at this public-private partnership arrangement. Can we afford to build all the schools we have to do to attract the younger families? Second thing is to, you know, how can you look at what your strengths are and to make sure that you capitalize on those. You know, we started out, we've got Frontier, we've got, as I said, Charter coming in. And
Henkel.
Henkel, you know, and we have all these other industries. I mean, Henkel is one of the biggest packaged goods companies in the country. So we want to and make sure that you allow for the free movement of people wherever you can. Get the parking in. Get your we have a new Wi-Fi that's through Frontier. That's a public Wi-Fi that's going to be very, very important to businesses as they grow as well.
Wait a minute. Let me just quickly here. Is it fair to apply the standards of Stamford's management, positive things that you've done in Stamford, to the rest of the state when Stamford has two huge advantages that no other city has? Number one, you're 1 hour from New York on the train, and you're essentially an edge city to New York. And number two, Stamford has the old Stamford Town, and that would be as if Bridgeport had Trumbull attached to it, or Hartford had West Hartford attached to it, or New Haven had Woodbridge. That gives you the ability to have lower taxes. Is it fair to say we've done a great job when in reality you have those two things that other cities don't have?
Yeah, we got the city. It was called the city and town, and they combined in 1949. Mm. In fact, our town clerk is still called the city and town clerk. North Stamford isn't doing as well as the downtown because of the demographic and cultural shifts that we find ourselves in now. My children don't want the china, the silverware,
etc.
The way
it is nowadays.
But yet, every time a house is sold in North Stamford, someone's bought a house in North Stamford. So we're continuing to maintain our population. But again, the bubble that was fueled by corporations moving people in and out and the way North Stamford was settled, not the same. But to answer your question, we do have those advantages, and it would have been a shame if we had not capitalized them and let ourselves to continue on the spending spree and the lack of attention to detail. And that's why I think we're in a position to move forward in the rest of this decade.
So build on your strengths. Dan, we only have a minute or two left. I want to get your final thoughts as you look forward. And I know that you and I have spoken in the past. And it's not a column because I think some people will see this as like almost a put down of Connecticut. You're saying it can be done. There are solutions, but there are things that you have to do.
You have to market to people in a different way. You have to have a positive attitude. You have to not be too extreme politically. And really importantly, something we don't want to hear is you have to wait this out because equilibrium does happen. At a certain point, people get tired of living 5-2 an apartment in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, taking a 2-hour subway a day, an hour each way, and Connecticut starts to look pretty good, and we hope that happens. But that equilibrium takes time, as does the long-term cutting back of the liabilities, health and pension liabilities. You can't do that in 5 years. You cannot take a $100 billion liability and knock it down. I'm sorry, the folks that are screaming about this, the trolls, and we know who they are, you just can't stop having the liabilities. It takes time on the real estate side, on the attitude side, and on the liability side.
Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Bob Lyon, member of the City of Stamford.
Great
Board
to be
of Representatives.
You
thank you, Bob. Finally, we want to get the thoughts of Kevin Lembo. Kevin is Connecticut's controller. He keeps an eye on the state's finances. He runs the health care plans for the state's employees, both current and retired, and he's the one who he pays the bills for the state. Controller Lembo, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Hey, Ron. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for coming on. Dan says if you look at the numbers, if you look at housing, employment, real GDP growth, the last decade was a lost one for Connecticut. How do you see it?
Modest. You know, a little bit of that sawtooth pattern that we've talked about before, a little up, a little down. And the only thing you can do, and I completely agree with what Dan just said, the only thing you can do in the face of an economy recovery, 117 months of recovery, and that up and down sawtooth pattern is get control over your expenses, get control over your liabilities, and figure out how to just power through it while keeping your obligations.
As you and I have talked about in the past, we didn't just suddenly get here, right? I mean, these were problems not dealt with for decades by both Republicans and Democratic administrations. But now have we reached a point where, I hate to use the word drastic, but where drastic measures must be taken?
No, I think a lot of the hard work in this supposed lost decade has been done. You know, when I think back to 2010, 2011, and I look through the work that we did at that point, it was about taking a hold of that pension liability and trying to make it more predictable over time. It was about grabbing big healthcare costs and trying to sort of get those wrestled under control. It was about using the state's purchasing power to make a difference in the lives of small businesses and others. So that those are the building blocks that you need, together with government doing what government does well, and stop trying to be all things to all people, which for a long time is what government was doing.
Connecticut is known as the land of steady habits. It's not exactly the wild and crazy kind of guy. Is that part of the problem, that the state needs to embrace new ideas, new ways of thinking? Get out of the box?
Absolutely. So the land of steady habits, and a lot of them weren't good. That together with this, I don't know what it is, puritanical, ancient thinking about if it's a good day, something bad's about to happen, is striking to me. You know, coming, not being born in Connecticut, coming here by choice, I see some things that I don't see in other places. And this whole idea that it's a great idea to talk down your economy, it's a great idea always to hate on your government while not doing anything to try to elect the people that you think would do a better job, is a little wacky to me. I don't quite understand it. So if we could use that land of steady habits profile, take the plans that we've put in place already, add in the things that need to be done going forward, and then just stick to the plan. Keep your head down. Stop being distracted by every shiny thing that comes our way. Stop trying to be New York, but be your best self. Be the best Connecticut we can be. How do we maximize Hartford? How do we maximize Stamford? How do we maximize New Haven? As Dan pointed out correctly, I think when you get to that point and you're doing your job well and you're being predictable, and people know what to expect going forward, then you become a much more attractive proposition because of the PhDs per capita, you know, the quality of life that we have here, both the culture and the arts and healthcare and schools, all the things that we know are great about Connecticut. I joke that sometimes if we can take one of those grad students that's about to finish up, and if we can keep them here until they fall in love and start to think about having a family, we've got them. But it's that in-between time where you have that brain drain, you lose those folks, and it's hard to get them back after that happens.
You know, over the holidays, I talked with a number of family members and friends who live on Long Island, and they were telling me that their five-year plan was to move, primarily because of taxes. And I'm wondering, how do you view that for Connecticut? How important is it to keep the taxes down, or as the governor has promised, to give some property tax relief? Where would that rate on the list?
It has to be high. So I don't think when we're trying to calculate what we should do here, you can necessarily compare yourself to some of the places where we see out-migration occurring, like where we see folks going from Long Island or Connecticut or New Jersey and other places to Florida where there is no income tax. I don't think that's a reasonable side-by-side comparison. But that's not to say that there aren't plenty of middle-class folks, retirees living in Connecticut, who could go anywhere and may want to flee the snow, may want to flee some of the other things that we can never do anything about, but we're incentivizing them to go by that lack of predictability and by the level of burden. The property tax is nuts. Like, can we just acknowledge that and then have a serious conversation about it? And it's been done a number of times, but when it comes down to, okay, what do you do now? That's when people get all squishy, because you'll hear things like, well, I chose to live here. I know what the property tax burdens were. I knew that I wanted to send my kid to these schools in this community for whatever reasons, and now you want to sort of take away our ability to fund that. For as many times as I heard the taxes are too high, or the property taxes are too high in particular, I've heard folks say, no, 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 don't think you're going to just squash this down and level the playing field across the state, because when you do that, then why live in place A over place B? And that's a troubling problem. And when you lose legislators because their constituents start to make some noise about that, then you'll never get anything like that through the Capitol that I happen to be staring at through my window right now.
What about in the final minute that I have, what about the idea that Connecticut is simply too hard on itself, that the state and its residents should have a little bit more pride?
Well, they should. We have so much to be proud of, and I think I tried to detail some of that a few minutes ago, Ron. And that's only scratching the surface. This is a place where people choose to be, where companies and business owners, when they're looking at the side-by-side comparison, do I put down in Massachusetts, do I put down in New York, or do I put down in Connecticut some sort of presence, some sort of manufacturing, they know what our strengths are. It's that lack of predictability that makes them nervous. It's the unfunded liability that send that message. But those are quantifiable and solvable. And when we do that work, you get positive messages from the rating agencies, you get positive messages from the business community, and then you just need to not change the rules of the road every 20 minutes. We have a lot to be proud of, and it's about time we decide that we want to come together, solve the problems, and really cheerlead what is an amazing place. I was at a business forum last year, and I finally had to say, you know, if you're going to threaten to leave Connecticut every time something doesn't go your way, please just go now, because, you know, we need folks who are in this for the long haul and want to collaborate, want to disagree, want to compromise, and want to move forward together. So I believe Connecticut is that place, and I'm proud to live here.
Kevin Lembo, he's Connecticut's controller. Thank you, sir. We always appreciate your time.
Always good to talk to you.
Take care.
Take care.
If you want to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at TFS at WSHU.org. On Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU. It's going to do it for our show today. It was an intriguing one. I want to thank all our guests. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.